Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com. Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
You are.
This is special coverage from WBUR in Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. Last year, President Bush warned that there might be deficits if the country was hit by recession, war, or national emergency. Now, the $2 trillion federal budget is about to go into the red. This hour, we say goodbye to the surplus with Harvard economist Benjamin Friedman and take a closer look at the meaning of the looming deficit in 2002 and beyond. First, the fragile quiet in the Middle East is shattered again as Palestinian militants attack an Israeli army post in Gaza. Four Israeli soldiers and two Palestinians have died. Hamas has claimed responsibility for the attack. Amos Harel is covering the story for the Israeli newspaper Haaretz. I asked him to put the latest developments in context in the ongoing struggle.
We've had a few weeks of relative quiet ever since the suicide bomber attacks and during the beginning of December. After that, Israel had acted pretty harshly inside the Palestinian territories, and there was a tremendous amount of pressure from the United States and also from the European community on Chairman Arafat. And what happened was that he finally began taking some action against his militants. But it seems that this wasn't enough because earlier today there was an attack on an Israeli outpost on the border of the Gaza Strip where two Hamas militants attacked a group of soldiers and four of them were killed. Also, both the two Hamas gunmen were also, two Palestinian gunmen were also killed. Of course, this has brought a change in the situation and everything is very tense again.
We always hear about, we always see this back and forth violence. Whose agenda is being played out here? Israel, of course, condemns these attacks. The Palestinian Authority and Arafat have also condemned the attacks. What's the backstory? What's going on here?
There is a difference between what Arafat says publicly and between what he does actually does.
Are you suggesting then that he actually supports this, or is this some rogue element
supports,
out of his control?
I think it sort of turns a blind eye. He doesn't really act against those people. Of the two Hamas gunmen who were killed today at this battle, at this incident, one of them was actually an officer in one of the Palestinian security services. He was also a member of Hamas. So this is a guy who probably his commanders knew about. The other one was wanted by Israel and his name was given to the Palestinian side during the last few months with a demand to arrest him. Nothing was done to these two, and nothing is done to Hamas leaders who are situated in Gaza, not far away from where the incident took place. Mm. This is the Israeli claim. This is what Israel is saying. And this is why it blames Arafat for the situation.
So you're suggesting that Arafat's condemnation is not genuine or at least not linked to effective action. What would Arafat's interest be in this kind of violence going on at this point?
Because Arafat has not achieved a lot. He has not been given what he wanted. When the Palestinians started this struggle, started the Al-Aqsa Intifada in September 2000, this happened in September after the negotiations in Camp David have collapsed in July. And at least Israelis believe that Arafat did not reach what he wanted, did not achieve what he wanted in Camp David, and was some kind of decision made in Palestinian between Palestinian leaders to try the violent way to achieve things. But what happened is that actually not much has been achieved. We're still stuck at the same situation we were since September. The only difference is that hundreds and hundreds of people were killed. Of course, more Palestinians than Israelis, but there have been heavy casualties on both sides.
But Amos Harel, then you're suggesting that despite all that death and despite the lack of success of the violent path to this point, that Yasser Arafat, you're suggesting, is still using violence. It doesn't seem to make sense anymore. It hasn't worked.
It doesn't. I think it's pretty hard to explain once you're out of the Middle East. Lucky for you, anyway. But this is the way the logic works here.
Are you suggesting that the Palestinian Authority thinks that they can still punish Israel to the negotiating table, that they can inflict enough pain that Israel would turn around its current stance and say, all right, we give up, we'll talk to you again?
This is one way of putting it. The other is that the Palestinians don't see any chance for a real negotiation right now. They don't see a way to push Israelis to agree with what they need. And they're saying if we won't get it, if we're not reaching peace, then let's continue the struggle. We've been struggling for that for 50 so years. We'll go on, and maybe one day we'll be strong enough to make Israel do what we were expecting it to do. But until then, we don't have much choice, and we have to fight. And of course, you have to consider that the Palestinians are having a very hard time, that Palestinian people have been, I've mentioned it before, that so many of them have been killed, that they're, I mean, the economy there is in a terrible situation. People are hardly able to get out of their towns, of their cities. And this brings a lot of contempt towards the Israelis. And of course, the Hamas and the Islamic Jihad, the militants, feel that way. But I guess that also Arafat himself has not decided yet to move on, to go back to the negotiations. He's saying publicly that he's willing to do that, but not much has been done to prove to Israelis that this is really what he means to do.
Amos Harel is military correspondent for Haaretz. He spoke to us from Tel Aviv. In 1998, the U.S. government took in $70 billion more than it spent, the first federal budget surplus in over 20 years. Now, it's fast disappearing. But how much of a difference does a surplus, or a deficit for that matter, make to the economy? How will it change the economic two-step of Republicans and Democrats on Capitol Hill? What do you remember about the deficits of the 1980s and the surpluses of the late 1990s? You can join our conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining us now is Benjamin Friedman. He's a celebrated economics professor at Harvard University and author of Day of Reckoning, The Consequences of American Economic Policy Under Reagan and After. Good evening, Professor Benjamin Friedman.
Hello.
Hi, thanks for joining us.
I'm delighted.
We're also joined from the studios of Vermont Public Radio by special coverage news analyst Jack Beatty, a senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom.
Professor Benjamin Friedman, where did the budget surplus go?
I think it went to three places. Number one on the list would be the Bush tax cut, which was enacted last year. Number two on the list would be the down economy. We've got a recession. That means tax revenues are down. And number three, certainly in last place, would be the additional spending that the government has done and is doing to combat terrorism.
Benjamin Friedman, I'm looking back at an op-ed piece that you wrote for the Boston Globe in October of 1998, and there's a tremendous glow of positive nostalgia about it already. You're really, over two pages here, celebrating the arrival of the surplus and talking about all the good that would flow out of that, saying, among other things, that most people were predicting that the government would stay in the black and the surplus would grow steadily larger for the next 10 years. In losing the surplus, what has the United States now lost?
I think the main problem with a government deficit instead of a surplus is that it drains our ability to invest in the economy. We need more factories, we need more machines, we need more up-to-date equipment, we need research and development. All of these things are impaired by our government deficit.
And how does that work? Why is that, Benjamin Friedman?
The linkage is through borrowing in the financial markets. When businesses build a new factory or when they modernize an old factory, typically they turn to the financial markets to raise funds to do it. They either borrow or they issue new stock. And the price at which they can issue the stock or the interest rate at which they borrow depends on the balance of supply and demand of funds in the market. Mm-hmm. When the government runs a deficit, that means the government itself is borrowing in the market, competing with those firms, and that drives the interest rate higher. And incidentally, this is the same pressure that people borrowing to take out a mortgage to build a new house feel.
Mm-hmm.
And conversely, if the government, as you said a minute ago, is taking in more than it's spending, if it's running a surplus, then instead of taking funds out of the financial markets and competing with businesses and homeowners, then the government is helping them by putting funds back into the financial market so that they can borrow more cheaply. I think that's the main thing going on.
Millions of Americans had never experienced been alive during the time of a national budget surplus until 1998. Describe for us, Benjamin Friedman, the scale of the achievement that it was in accomplishing that surplus and what it took to get there.
I think it was a historic achievement. It took place through several steps, and frankly, there's a lot of credit to go around. I think the beginning of the process was President Bush's budget plan in 1990. He took a lot of heat for that, but he did raise taxes. And
that's President Bush the first.
Yes, that's right. Mm-hmm. President George H.W. Bush in 1990. He gets part of the credit. Second, I think an enormous part of the credit goes to President Clinton with his budget plan in 1993. It's interesting to look back and see how vigorously that was opposed. People said it would arrest the economic recovery. Of course, it did no such thing. It helped the economic recovery. That, incidentally, was the only piece of modern legislation ever passed on a major policy issue without a single vote from the opposing party. Every single Republican senator voted against that, but it passed over their objection, and I thought that was the second major piece. And then, frankly, I would give a fair amount of credit also to the new Republican Congress that was elected in 95, which held down spending compared to what it probably would have been otherwise. So I think there's plenty of credit to go around, but I think your sense that this was an achievement of really historic proportions in the context of American political policy, I think that's quite right.
Well, it certainly raised everyone's optimism about the future. And, of course, the 90s turned out to be a heck of a boom. How much of the 90s boom would you credit to the emergence of fiscal discipline and a budget surplus?
I don't think anybody knows that. We'd love to know the answer to that. The one thing I would point to is that the primary argument that all of us made right through the 80s and early 90s, when we were complaining so vigorously about the budget deficits at that time, was that they were taking money away from investment. And the main point was that if we got the deficit down and, better yet, replaced it with a surplus, then the economy's investment rate would go back up. And sure enough, what was the main driver of the economic boom of the 90s? It was an investment boom. Mm-hmm. The economy's rate of building new factories, putting in place new machinery, all that was higher in the 90s than we had seen for many, many years. Now, you ask the question I'd love to answer. Can we say that accounted for 40% of the boom? Was it 65%? I sure wish I knew, but the truth is I don't.
You give it some credit?
Absolutely. It's hard to believe it was small, but where it was, I don't know.
Jack Beatty, and now that surplus is gone.
It is gone, it is gone not just in the official line is a $1.3 trillion tax cut, but really when you count in foregone higher interest payments on the higher national debt, it's more like $2 trillion. And its effect over the economy, Professor Friedman can tell us, but it's just interesting politically, that money, that surplus was supposed to cover the shortfall in Social Security that's building to the year 2016, when there are going to be more claims on that money than there will be money available. And that's gone away now. And President Bush's answer to that is, well, he says he's had a commission that apparently has just no respect at all because it had no contrary views, that will privatize a portion of Social Security, invest it in the markets, and that deus ex machina will bring us back, will take care of the Social Security problem. Practically no one believes that. In effect, unless that surplus is restored, we will either have to increase taxes on Social Security to pay for that or cut benefits. A third alternative is to raise the age at which people can retire. And, of course, that's a hardship for manual workers. So the president is building in not just a short-term crisis with this tax cut. That is to say, the budget has disappeared, the surplus has disappeared, but a long-term one in the shape of the Social Security crisis.
Mm. Professor Friedman, we got to go to a break, but in a word, where do you rank Social Security among the things affected by the loss of the surplus?
I think Social Security is very much at risk, and I think switching from a surplus to a deficit greatly increases that risk.
We've got a lot to talk about tonight. We have Professor Benjamin Friedman, economics professor at Harvard University, with us, and our own special coverage news analyst, Jack Beatty. You can join us as well. Did you feel the future looked rosier when the bottom line was black? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Aware, aware, did that surplus go? I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to special coverage from WBUR Boston. This is special coverage from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about the incredible vanishing U.S. national budget surplus. President Bush says, watch out, the deficit is coming. We had a deficit for years. We finally had a surplus. It hasn't lasted long. What should we do about it? How do you feel about it? How do you think it may affect your life, your family, your pocketbook? We're at 1-800-423-8255. We're joined by Harvard economics professor Benjamin Friedman and our own Jack Beatty. Benjamin Friedman, we want to talk about Social Security, but before we go there, how would you apportion the causes of the disappearance of the surplus? You cited the tax cut, the downturn of the economy, the new war. Is there any way that you can divide up that pie? What's most responsible here?
I think if we're looking at this year and next year only, then the down economy is in first place, the tax cut is in second place, and the war, including domestic terrorism charges, are in third place.
Mm-hmm.
But as Jack's comments made clear, this is not a problem of this year and next year. The problem is ongoing, and the threat to Social Security, for example, is one that we're going to have to face as we go out through the decade. The further out into the decade we look, the more the tax cut looms as the major mistake that we've made, and the less we should attach to the down economy, because most people, and I too, think the economy is going to improve by sometime next year or certainly on into 2003. And so if we're looking at 2004, 2005, mm-hmm. and asking why is the U.S. government going to have a budget deficit in those years also, it's hard to blame the fact that the economy was down in 2001 and 2002. Mm. So I think the further out we look, the more we have to point to the tax cut, and the more we will be looking toward any increases in military spending and domestic anti-terrorism spending.
President George W. Bush said this week that getting rid of the tax cut, that raising taxes, in his words, would be a disaster for the economy. It was certainly a political disaster, in part perhaps for his father. But between the lines, do I hear you yearning for a rollback of the tax cut?
We have to distinguish very carefully. In the same way that what regimen is good for you or your body when you have a cold is not the same regimen as what you want to do when you're healthy. For mm-hmm. example, when you're healthy, it's a good thing to go out and run a few miles a day or get a lot of exercise. Mm-hmm. And when you have the flu, that's a lousy idea.
Okay, translate.
Similarly, I think you have to distinguish very carefully between what we want to do right now while the economy is in the midst of a recession and what policies we want to have in place a year from now, 18 months from now, 2.5 years from now, when the economy is, we hope, going to be healthy again. I agree with President Bush that raising taxes now would be foolish.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody should want to raise taxes in the middle of a recession. But to repeat, by a year from now, or 2 years from now, or certainly 3 years from now, we're not going to be in recession anymore. And at that time, I think continuing forward with the tax cuts that just keep on coming under the legislation passed last year would be a mistake. So, yes, looking forward to 2004, 2005, and on into the rest of the decade, I would recommend that we repeal those parts of the tax cut that have not yet taken place and that are scheduled to come into play later on in the decade.
Jack Beatty, what do you see as the political prospects for that actually happening?
I don't know. I mean, the president has put the Democrats into a box, by saying that even an effort to rescind the taxes is a tax increase. I don't know how they get out of it. But, you know, on the merits, I don't see if the Democrats can't make a fight over the particulars of those taxes at this time, then there's something wrong with the party. Admittedly, 12 of their senators voted for this package. But look what the package would do going forward. 43% of the benefit of this tax cut went to, I think, the top 5%. And that is what is to come, the rate reduction from 39 point something down for the top earners. Mm-hmm. And the second big hit going forward is the elimination of the inheritance tax. Now, that would affect 0.1% of taxpayers. So for the sake of 0.1% of taxpayers, current taxpayers are going to have to pay probably more in state taxes because the federal government is going to have less to give to the states. Social Security is now, according to Paul Krugman, 30 cents of every dollar now contributed to Social Security is going to pay for these tax cuts looking forward. So current Social Security payers mm-hmm. are in effect paying for the tax cut that went to this 0.1% of the population. So if the Democrats can't make a fight around basically 6% of the population, there's something very wrong with that party.
Benjamin Friedman, there's clearly a lot at stake here. Describe a little more fully for us how long and deep you think this deficit might be. The last time we were in deficit spending for a long, long time. So how long might that go? And what might the consequences be? Start with Social Security and look right across the economy, if you will.
I think the risk to Social Security, as Jack makes clear, is that once the baby boomers start to retire, Social Security is going to be under pressure. Now, it's not going to run out of money instantly. Under current projections, the Social Security system will be able to draw on its surplus for quite a few years. So the risk to Social Security is one that doesn't come until, 20 years or so from now, maybe longer than that. And that's one of the reasons why it's difficult to deal with the problem. The American body politic is very good about dealing with immediate problems. Look at how magnificently our country has reacted to the terrorist attacks, and look at how much support we've given the president and for the war effort. Mm-hmm. We always react well in circumstances of immediate crisis. We never do well. Historically, we haven't done it in being able to think clearly about prospects that are problematic but way down the road. So I think Social Security is at risk, but it's not going to be at risk for quite a few years to come, and that makes it difficult to deal with. How long will we remain in deficit? My fear is that if we don't do anything about it, we're going to be in deficit for a very long time. But you see, that's a big if. That was the issue back in the 80s and the 90s. People said that we would have deficits as far as the eye could mm-hmm. see, I think was the phrase. But that was if we didn't do anything about it. And I think economists did their part. Journalists, including radio journalists, did their part. Politicians did their part. And as I said before, I would give a lot of credit to the first President Bush and also to President Carter and also to the Republican majority when it came into Congress. And putting all that together, that if changed. It wasn't that the policies remain unchanged. The policies did change, and as a result, what looked like deficits as far as the eye could see turned into not only surpluses, but pretty big surpluses, too. Mm. So I think the approach that I think is right is not just to sit back and forecast and say whatever will be, but rather to say these are matters of human choice. These are matters of political action, and the right thing to do is to educate the public about what's going on and what the risks are and hope that the policies will change.
We're talking about America's incredible vanishing surplus with economist Benjamin Friedman and our own Jack Beatty. Benjamin Friedman says deficit is not destiny. It can be turned around, but right now we are on the red ink railway. You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. A lot of callers are waiting to come in. Victor's calling from Merrimack, New Hampshire. Welcome, Victor. You're on the line.
Well, hi there.
Hi.
Nice show.
Good to have you.
I do have a question for Professor Friedman.
Yes, sir.
He said that that the government puts money into the economy when it runs a surplus, or into the credit markets.
Into the financial markets.
I'm not sure how that works, but my question is, I'd rather see a small surplus instead of a large surplus, because I don't see why it's different for the government to take money out of the economy to put it back into the economy. Why is that better than just leaving the money in the economy to begin with?
Victor, thanks for your call. It sounds, Benjamin Friedman, like this is, I'd rather have my tax money in my pocket than in the government's pocket. But how do you respond?
The answer is the point that Jack was making before about Social Security. So let me illustrate with the few numbers for the upcoming fiscal year, that is fiscal year 2003, for which the president will be submitting his budget in another week or two.
Mm-hmm.
In the year 2003, the Social Security system will be running its own surplus of $190 billion.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the Social Security system's way of accumulating a nest egg so that it will be there to help pay the baby boomers' retirement.
Mm-hmm.
When we say that the government overall will have a small surplus or small deficit in 2003, that means that the government is using that $190 billion in order to pay for a shortage in everything else that the government does.
Mm-hmm.
So if the government had reported exactly a zero budget in 2003, or if Mr. Bush were to propose next week an exactly balanced budget for 2003,
mm-hmm.
what that really means is that he's saying, let the entire $190 billion surplus that's going into the Social Security Trust Fund, supposedly to be there for the baby boomers' retirement, let's use that to pay the shortfall everywhere else.
Mm-hmm. So it all comes back to that Social Security lockbox or pool or well to dip into, I guess.
I think so. I think this lockbox has been pulverized is the quick of it. And if it were not for the fact that the Social Security system needs to be and is building up this big surplus, then I would very much agree with what Victor said. In that case, why bother having the government run a surplus? Why not just have it run an even account? But in this case, if the government were to run an even account in everything else it did, then the overall surplus for the coming fiscal year would be $190 billion, because that's mm-hmm. the surplus in the Social Security Fund alone.
Victor, thanks for your call. Mark is on the line. Welcome, Mark. You're on the air.
Hi, thanks. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Good show, good topic.
Sure.
One of my concerns is that we're collectively missing the large picture here, and we're talking about a relatively small government deficit that can be managed on a taxation versus a bloated government spending basis. But what concerns me is that going into the 1990 recession,
mm-hmm.
We had consumer floating rate debt at about $800 billion, which at that time was a huge number. Going into this recession right now, and I kind of disagree with most folks that I think that we're going to be in this a little bit longer than the current predictions are for a six-month turnaround from here,
mm-hmm.
is that we have $7.25 trillion of consumer floating rate debt. And people right now, we have this collective myopic view that if the government's in balance, everything else is fine. But we have consumers out there that are using credit cards to pay taxes, dual-wage earner families, that are effectively keeping the real estate market afloat.
Mm.
And nobody's talking about this consumer debt bomb that is coming at us like a racehorse.
Mark, it's an interesting point. Let's put it to Professor Benjamin Friedman. What about it? Have we bred another kind of deficit here? And how does its impact compare to that of a federal budget deficit?
I think Mark is quite right. I think this is a serious potential problem. The reason it hasn't been much of an actual problem lately is that interest rates are so low. But the crucial word in his question, and again, he's exactly right, is that so much of that debt is floating rate debt. And what that means is that if a return of inflation, which I don't think is likely, or if a return to budget deficits, which we all agree is likely, or if yet some other factor starts to push up interest rates in our economy, then all those consumers who are paying floating rate interest rates on their home mortgages or on their credit card debt will suddenly find more and more money coming out of their pocket just to pay the interest. And it's a separate problem from the one we're talking about, but I certainly agree with Mark. That's a problem.
But it's a big one. Alan's on the line. Welcome, Alan. You're on the air.
Yes, my concern is more immediate than Social Security. I think with budget deficits, we're going to see a spike in the interest rates, and the majority of people refinancing and purchasing homes are buying with adjustable rate notes that have 2-point caps per year, but they can go up 2 points every year, up to 14, 16, 18%. And if all these people wind up getting their notes spiked up with an interest rate spike, they're
going to
go into foreclosure. It'll cut away the whole underpinning of our whole financial situation here with home ownership. What do we do about this, and where do you see interest rates going in the next 2 years?
It's a good question, and enough to send a shiver up a lot of spines. Benjamin Friedman, what about it? Interest rates, real estate market, and where's it headed?
I think Alan's right in the same way that Mark was right just before him. The point is that many people, Alan is pointing to the people who have borrowed at floating rates to finance home purchases. Mark was pointing more to people who had borrowed at floating rates on their credit cards, but it's really the same issue on both sides. If interest rates start to go up, then people will have to have more dollars coming out of their pocket every month just to meet the interest bill. Now, I don't think you have to be very much of an economic forecaster to see that interest rates on short-term debt in the United States are at a historic low at the moment.
Mm-hmm.
And so the Treasury bill rates are almost certain to go up over the next few years. It would be astonishing if that were not so. The harder question, and one that I'm not going to answer, not because I'm being coy, but because I don't know the answer, is whether these longer-term interest rates that many people pay, for example, longer-term home mortgage rates, some of the credit card rates, whether they will go up. So I think in answer to the question, if you're borrowing in a way that is tied to the Treasury bill rate or the commercial paper rate or something else that's very short-term, it's not hard to know you're going to be paying a higher interest rate a couple of years from now. If you're borrowing at a longer-term rate, say a 10-year rate, or you have something that's tied to the 10-year Treasury rate, I think that's a much harder question, and I don't know.
Jack Beatty, we're laying out here with Benjamin Friedman a pretty tough skyline of what deficits mean just now.
Yeah. Yeah, it's it really is illuminating. You know, in the 80s, we heard that the idea that that a fiscal balance could be dynamic economically, we heard that was eating your spinach. That was spinach economics. We heard this from supply side economists, of whom the president's chief advisor Lawrence Lindsay is one. And we heard that what dynamic growth came from tax cuts. We've just been hearing how President Clinton raised taxes, and through the medium that the professor has outlined, we had dynamic growth. This is quite we've sort of proven that, hey, wait a minute, tax increases are not necessarily contraction, unless they happen in a recession.
But we proved something else, too, when President George H.W. Bush lost the presidency after reading his lips and unreading his lips. I think his son is paying attention to that right now. We're talking about the deficit, the surplus. Where's the surplus gone? Join us at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to special coverage from WBUR Boston. This is special coverage from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We're talking tonight with Professor Benjamin Friedman, economics professor at Harvard University, about the vanishing U.S. budget surplus and its consequences. What do you think? Do you miss the budget surplus already? Are you willing to give up a tax cut to get it back? You can join our conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Benjamin Friedman, I'm looking in the New York Times, just today's issue, and they're quoting economists arguing about whether or not deficits matter to the economy. They quote Professor John H. Cochran, University of Chicago economics professor, saying there's no evidence whatsoever that budget deficits by themselves have any influence on long-term rates. What do you say?
I don't agree with that statement. I know John Cochran. He's a very fine economist, so I wouldn't at all want to say he's being silly. I think the problem in figuring out what's causing what in economics is that it's very unusual that only one thing is happening at once. Mm-hmm. If we had a budget deficit and that was the only thing going on, it'd be simple to look and see what happened and what didn't happen. And I think what John is pointing to is that when we have budget deficits, typically a lot else is going on in the economy. And so inevitably it's a judgment call about whether it was the deficit that caused something like a higher interest rate to happen or whether it was something else that went on. My judgment is different from his. I believe that the effect of government borrowing that's caused by deficits at full employment is indeed to push interest rates higher, and it is to make the economy's investment rate lower, and in the long run that depresses our mm-hmm. ability to enjoy productivity growth and ultimately growth in our standard of living. And I think the great advantages that we saw in the 1990s when the deficit gave way to a surplus, we had interest rates come down, we had the investment rate go up, we had productivity go up, we had wages go up. I think all that's an example, but it's true that the deficit coming down and turning into a surplus was not the only thing going on in the 90s. And so there's room for disagreement, and I respect his view, but I disagree with it.
Greg is calling from Amherst, New Hampshire. Welcome, Greg. You're on the air.
Hello.
Hi.
I definitely enjoy your program.
Thanks.
One of the questions, comments I had was that in what I've been listening to, you've only been talking about budget surplus and deficits on an annual basis.
Mm-hmm.
Overall, there is a very large deficit that the surpluses of the 90s were working on paying down.
The national debt.
Accomplished that.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess hearing nothing about that, I myself would very much like to pay down that debt. And that's in addition to the surplus that mm-hmm. Social Security brings about.
Mm-hmm. Greg, it's an interesting point. Let's put it to Benjamin Friedman. I guess, first, were we on track to pay down the national debt? How important is that? And what else might we have we lost our capacity to address in losing the surplus?
Most economists, and I would include myself here, think that the annual flow of the surplus or the deficit is more important in an economy like the United States than the actual volume of debt outstanding. Now, if we were Argentina and we were borrowing a lot from abroad and moreover borrowing in some country, some currency other than our own, then we'd have a big problem and we'd want to pay a lot of attention to how big the debt is compared to our economy. But fortunately, we're not Argentina. And our debt is not that big compared to our national income. And moreover, we, unlike other countries, enjoy the advantage of being able to borrow in our own currency. Now, the point is quite right. Because the government has run deficits year after year for so many years, since World War II and actually during the war as well, by the time we got to the early 1990s, there was about $4 trillion of debt outstanding with the U.S. government's name on it. And now finally, during the last few years, we've paid down a little bit of that debt. Every time you run a surplus, what do you do with it? You use it to pay off the debt. That's what the government does. So we ate away a little bit at the outstanding debt. And, of course, the economy grew, and so compared to our national income, the outstanding debt is now quite a bit smaller than it was 10 years ago. But I think whether the debt remains at or near its current level and therefore continues to shrink as slowly as our national income grows, or whether the debt actually goes down year by year with a surplus, is, in my mind, not as major a consideration as whether the government is adding to the funds that are available in the financial markets, available for to finance investment, mm-hmm. or whether deficit the government is taking away from that.
Benjamin Friedman, you've opened our eyes tonight. Our time's running down. I'm not sure I like what we see, but we appreciate your illuminating the horizon for us. Thanks so much for joining us.
I've enjoyed the conversation. Thank you.
Benjamin Friedman is economics professor at Harvard University and author of Day of Reckoning, The Consequences of American Economic Policy Under Reagan and After. Jack Beatty, it's not a pretty picture out there on this front, but yet, as you say, neither Republicans or Democrats are standing up loudly to ask for a reversal of the Bush tax cuts.
No, and you know, this question of the national debt, as a symbol, this matters. I mean, this is about posterity, as is Social Security. And one of the things we expect of our leaders is to make the future present, to speak for Americans to come. Mm. And two presidents in the 1990s took courageous stands, a Republican and a Democrat, and the Republican Congress, to think of the future, to get the budget deficit, to get the budget into surplus, and to begin to pay down that debt. That's leadership.
It is, and I can't help recalling the kind of national pride that you saw America feel at a time when we were paying that down and we were in a surplus. As George W. Bush often said, we were treating the national budget like we'd like to treat our own household budget. It felt good.
It did. And now it's gone.
And now it's gone. Let's hope we can get it back. Jack, thanks for being with us this hour.
Thank you.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation online. Go to WBUR.org and click on Special Coverage Forums. Each night, callers to Special Coverage drive our discussion with their provocative questions and comments, but long after our show is through on air, the conversation among listeners continues on our internet forums. Lately, the United States' failure to capture Osama bin Laden has had our online forums buzzing. Tonight, we're sharing some of the comments. The discussion thread begins with a basic question. Who cares that the United States has not caught bin Laden?
What does it matter if we can't find him as long as he's in disgrace and can't show his face?
When Bush vowed to get him, I was wondering why he felt the need to say that. The appearance that the world's most powerful nation is mainly after one guy does not look good, especially since the odds of success may be 50-50 at best. Back in October, it was reported that bin Laden's people were trying to find him a dialysis machine, and there are rumors that he has other illnesses too. This may end with only a handful of Arabs taking the secret of where his grave is to their suicide bomb deaths.
Osama will not be found for some time. Then one fine morning, he will be reported to be hiding somewhere in Iraq. U.S. government will demand Saddam to hand him over. Naturally, he would refuse. The whole game of bombing will start all over again. Osama will then vanish one more time and reappear in Syria or Libya or Yemen.
If we found Osama tomorrow, the attention of the U.S. population to the war on terror would have a shorter half-life than most rare radioactive isotopes. There is a benefit to having the SOB stay at large, provided, of course, that he cannot continue to effectively operate al-Qaeda. The longer this goes on in a focused manner, the more damage will be done to the terrorist infrastructure.
This is a really interesting topic. Think about it. We have a man who is capable of planning sophisticated attacks on the World Trade Center. He knows how his enemy operates and responds. With all the things I have heard and read about this guy, I am not ready to believe, even for a second, that he is in that region after the attacks. He knew how the U.S. responds. Do you people believe that he would be fool enough to remain in Afghanistan?
I've often wondered the same thing. I'd place my bets on him being in the region, but not Afghanistan. Northern Yemen or Somalia, perhaps. Let's not make him out to be some kind of demigod, though. He's human, and he will make mistakes. And he will be caught and or killed. Bank on it.
Tony Blair has stated that many objectives have been met, even though Osama's not been found. Maybe the U.S. will next be asked to stop trying to get him, probably because the current efforts are mostly killing civilians. I suspect Bush is asking for help and backing off on the promise to get OBL. In Omar, well, the Afghans will not allow us to find him. No doubt that is why the stories of all the money taken from Afghan banks have been reiterated, this time clearly pointing the finger at Omar for every incident. Maybe the Afghans will no longer see him as one of them.
I don't think Bush is asking any such thing. Just because we can't find Osama bin Laden in 4 months, I don't think we are remotely considering throwing in the towel. I don't think the administration will rest until he's toast. But that isn't the same as we're going to get him by bombing Afghanistan. I'd also question the premise that current efforts are killing mostly civilians to any greater degree than our past actions have. I've always doubted that we could find Osama bin Laden in Afghanistan. Omar is a different matter. He's an Afghan, but he can't live underground forever. We'll get him sooner or later, with the Afghans' help or without them.
The tensions between India and Pakistan have also been a hot topic on our special coverage web forums. Here are some excerpts from that online conversation.
Mainland USA attacked, world sympathized. Other countries attacked, restraint preached. Is it a double standard?
Are you talking about U.S. recommendations for Israel and India-Pakistan? If so, I am interested in the answer to that. The only rationale I could muster would be that Afghanistan did not have a sovereign government for us to work with in an attempt to have them deal with their own terrorists. India and Pakistan should have been able to work things out.
Yes, I'm pointing to advice by Colin Powell to India and Pakistan about restraint. Being Indian, no doubt I'm outraged by such advice. It is quite understandable that nobody would like to rock the boat which is already trading bumpy waters. But there are limits for things to which a nation can stand. Look at the series of events. The Kashmir insurgency started around 1989. India, being a democracy, did not act militarily. Then a whole decade of carnage followed where many innocent lives, about 54,000, were lost. Again, there was no military response from India. Emboldened by this, India witnessed the Kargil War. Again, following the mantra of restraint, India just cleaned its own house and did not cross the border. Then came the attack on the Kashmir legislature. Again, there was restraint. All along, India followed the restraint that simply emboldened the terrorists. I think what they say is correct. The greater risk is not taking one.
What the U.S. says is only politics. In the case of Israel, if we really wanted Israel to show restraint and our politicians had the cojones to make them listen to us, they would show restraint. The actions by the Israeli Defense Force are signs that we obviously don't care that much. But we pay lip service to the Palestinians so as not to enrage the owners of our petroleum sources.
The USA definitely has a double standard. Just consider these facts, that over 30,000 people have been killed in Kashmir in the last decade, and that's about 8 times as many as on September 11th. Just imagine what it would be like if we had 8 pairs of World Trade Centers blown up by Canada or Mexico, and then were told by a country to exercise restraint. America should just say to Pakistan's general in no uncertain terms, shut down these terrorist groups or we will help India do it for you.
The Kashmiris don't want to be part of India. That, I think, is the real problem that many in India find hard to digest. While I'm not really opposed to military action against radical organizations who have butchered innocents in the name of freedom, I doubt crushing these organizations will stop the insurgency in Kashmir. India has tried to crush militant organizations for the last 20 years, but the insurgency has not really abated because the grounds for insurgency still remain strong. Alienation, oppressive tactics of the Indian military, and the Hindu-Muslim angle of the Kashmiri independence movement.
Excerpts from our internet forums. You can join in the online conversation too. Log on to WBUR.org and click on Special Coverage Forums. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is Special Coverage from WBUR Boston.
This is WB.